many people showed up and how many people keep coming. And I see the fact that our community is standing up for what's right, that I'm really proud to play the title of YU Scooter. About a week before I started CERN, in August of 2010, I was in Lombard, Pennsylvania, where I attended high school. And the Ramadan community sent out an email. They said that there would be this rally in Brooklyn on behalf of Tamara Etsy. It was the first time I ever heard of OGRA, the Organization for the Resolution of Abunut. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to go. It was too soon before school started. And so I started school that week. And the Wednesday of that week, the first day of classes, there were signs around school that there would be this rally taking place in Midtown for this Aguna, a name of a woman that I had never heard of. But I heard of OGRA, and a friend of mine was planning on going. So I figured I'd go. So I went to this rally. I felt a bit uncomfortable, chanting things on the streets of Manhattan. We all went back to school together. We heard a cheer from Rabbi Stern, and life went on. I recently found out that one of the primary reasons this get was given is because of that rally. Oroz mentioned that there might be a second rally, and that was one of the catalysts in making sure that the get was given. I and the other students who turned out that day to support a woman I never met before, and I've never seen her since, we made a difference in her life. Since then, I attended two rallies in Silver Spring on behalf of Tamara, and this semester I started the Aguna Advocacy Club. I got as involved as I could with the Aguna. After I finished hanging out prior to this panel this past Sunday night, and was heading back to my dorm, I asked myself why this cause and so many others had driven me. Why did OGRA matter so much to me? Partly is because the members of OGRA are some of the most incredible people I've ever met. They really dedicate their lives to the Jewish community. But there was more. After all, I just spent 2 hours working on the publicity of this panel, and I still had 2 midterms to study for, and was ready after midnight. There was something that caught me so much. And I think that what it really is that when I hear about a case of Igun, of get refusal, it angers me, because someone's taken halacha, taken that which is sacred to us, and twisted it for their own benefit. In Demarca, we're promised that the Torah, that halacha, will be what is seen as our wisdom in the eyes of the nations. But someone, a fellow Jew, a member of our community, decided that not only could he take this halacha and twist it selfishly, but he could twist it maliciously, that he could hurt someone with it. That's something that has to be intolerable to us. This panel is the final event in tax domestic violence and abuse awareness. There are 2 messages that we hope you all leave with today. First, that we as a community will not tolerate those who engage in get abuse. We must be aware that when someone is manipulating the divorce proceedings, and we must stand united to eradicate this problem. Further, we do have a solution to prevent further cases of Igun. Rav Mordechai Lilik, a Rosh Yeshiva of YU, has developed a halachic prenuptial agreement. There is no reason why any couple getting married today does not sign it. Thank you to our panelists for joining the class with us tonight. I am pleased to introduce, we have with us Dr. David Pelkovitz from Herschel Chapter, Rabbi Jeremy Stern, and Tamara Epstein. Dr. David Pelkovitz holds the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Chair in Psychology and Jewish Education at Asriadi Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration at YU. He is also a special assistant to President Richard M. Joel. Dr. Pelkovitz is an instructor in pastoral counseling at the Rabbi Isaac Elkanan Theological Seminary. Areas of Dr. Pelkovitz's specialty include family violence, the impact of domestic violence, and stress management. Rabbi Herschel Schachter, a noted Talmudic scholar, has had a distinguished career at the Rabbi Isaac Elkanan Theological Seminary for more than 40 years. He joined the faculty in 1967 at the age of 26, the youngest Rosh Yeshiva of Greece. Since 1971, Rav Schachter has been the Rosh Kola, the Marcos and Indian and Katz Kola, and also holds the Nathan and Vivian Queen Distinguished Professorial Chair in Kamala. We are especially grateful to Rav Schachter for agreeing to speak with us on such short notice. Unfortunately, due to the late change in plans, Rav Schachter had to leave a little bit early, and we thank him for the time he's able to join us. Rabbi Jeremy Stern serves as the Executive Director of the Organization for the Resolution of Aguna. Over. Rabbi Stern received his master's degree, master's in Jewish education, and rabbinic ordination from Yeshiva University. And he is now studying towards the MPA nonprofit administration. With ORAP, Rabbi Stern has been instrumental in resolving dozens of Hasbara cases and in leading community-wide initiatives to assist women who are the victims of gag refusal. Rabbi Stern lectures frequently on issues of domestic abuse, agunot, and the relevant prenuptial agreement. Many of you, if not all, have heard of Tamara's name before. Tamara is a nurse practitioner who lives in Philadelphia with her daughter. She's also an Agunot. While I know Tamara and the Aspen family from high school, and is actually with my teacher in AP U.S. History and Holocaust Studies, ORAP has also initiated a very public campaign to pressure Tamara's ex-husband, Aaron Friedman, to give her the gap that she has been waiting for. Tamara and Aaron were married in April 2006. They have been separated since March 2008 and civilly divorced since April 2010. Aaron was the plaintiff in all divorce matters pertaining to child custody and visitation. A SIRUP, an order of contempt by Basement, has been in effect against Aaron since September 2011. Without further ado, Dr. Helgood.
Thank you so much. I'm so moved by the turnout tonight. It says something very wonderful about the wonderful work being done by the organizers of this conference. As I asked to speak for about 10 minutes, talking about this issue from a psychological perspective, I'll start with the words of my Rebbe, Rav Palm, who I was privileged to learn with in this year for 4 or 5 years. When he used to talk about abuse, he would talk about duality. He would say, when you see somebody who's being faced with abusive behavior and you look the other way, among the many do-risas that you are really being over, you just look the other way. Salama. The end of the pasuk is hakeim takei nimo. You have to stand by them. But when you look at them and you help them and you're there to do everything you can to take them from a place of pain and silence to a place of support, among the many mitzvahs that you're mekayim is the mitzvah of hashavas aveda, because you're returning to them their lost soul. I'm just going to speak for a few minutes about a study done here by a group of you, undergraduates. Some of them are here. My daughter, Michal Pelkovitz, Stephanie Lerner-Hefter, and a number of others who interviewed a number of Agunot using a structured interview designed to capture the subtle and not so subtle psychological impact of what happens. And it was done with the support of ORAP. It couldn't have been done without ORAP. I just want to share with you a little bit about what you're turning away from when you're not there to be Makai in the Hukim Tukim Mimo. We found that about 75% of the women who were interviewed had a loss of a sense of meaning. It got to their basic sense of purpose in their life. This all comes under the category of normal reaction to abnormal events. About 1 in 5 hit such a level of despair that they started to contemplate actually self-harm. Not all, but about 1 in 5, like, which makes you just realize what an incredibly stressful situation it is and how important it is for us to stand at their side. 85% talked about compromised trust in our community, and I can go on with this. But I wanted to talk just for a few minutes about some of the even more invisible victims, what our study found with the children. Because the children were incredibly impacted. It shouldn't be surprising to us. There was significant impairment in their ability to learn. There was significant impairment in their sense of trust and protection. in their social functioning, in their emotional functioning, and you really saw sometimes the impact going into the next generation. Sometimes children living in this kind of situation, it starts to impact on their basic view of the world. And the eye sees only what the mind knows. What that study showed me, and I think is in many ways not surprising, is that often the pain is invisible. But that heightens our responsibility. I had a colleague who I've done some writing with, who once showed me, she's an expert in trauma, he once showed me the picture of an fMRI, the picture of a brain of one of his patients, at the moment that he was having a flashback to the worst moment of his life. He was stuck in the stairwell of the World Trade Center on 9/11, and he was treating him as part of trying to understand what was happening to him. He was actually able to take the picture of what does the brain look like when it's having a flashback to the most terrifying moment of its life. And it was an amazing thing to see. So when you look at it, what you saw was demimus. You saw what's meant by Ido Maro. Broca's area was shut down. Language centers of the brain were shut down. Then, what my colleague Dr. Vanderkolk was able to show, that as he gave his patient words for his pain, as he lit up the language centers of his brain by giving him meaning and giving him support, that's where the refuah came. And in fact, our Rabbi Charlotte's grandfather, Charlotte, in his Haggadah, Mei Marom, he says the following. He says, Akdus, slavery, takes away our koach hadibur. And when a week from tomorrow night we sit around the Seder, as a family, as a people, as a community, and we talk about our freedom and the meaning of our delivery from slavery, as we collectively light up the language centers of our people, he says, that's Magid, and Magid is the essence of what Pesach is about. What tonight's about, and the talks you're about to hear, is about naming the monsters, about the power of standing next to other people who are going through incredibly unjust treatment in a way that we give them words for their pain, show them support, and perhaps most importantly, hopefully, we'll be able for all of us collectively to mekayem in kind of the mitzvah of Hashanah Sameicha. Thank you.
Says as follows: in the event that the Bezin of our choice will determine that the husband is acting improperly by not giving his wife a gift. And the husband is already stating now, before he gets married, that he's obligated himself to pay his wife a certain amount from the zaydus and support of his wife. The husband is obligated to support his wife. To what extent is the husband obligated to support his wife? So the Gemara says, if his family is a very wealthy family, his parents were very wealthy, and they always went there to Israel for all the shol shagom, and then for the summertime they go to whatever, to Mexico, to New Zealand, whatever, they're always traveling around the world, and they have maids at home, and they have someone else do the shopping for them, and their mother never lifted, the boy's mother never lifted a finger to do work in the house, and the boy can afford it. He's not, even though the girl is very poor, she comes from a poor family, so the din is by Elohimo. The husband is obligated to support his wife the same way his father supported his mother. And if the boy came from a poor family, or if the boy's family never spent so much, spent so much on their vacations, and so much, the girl's family always lived that style of living, and the husband can afford it, so the husband is obligated to support his wife the same way his in-laws live. That's the halacha in the Gemara. Oilo ibo deni eretz ibo. You have to take the higher style of living of the two families. So how much support does the husband believe to give his wife? Well, it depends about the two families. So if the husband will write in the document that if the bezmen of our choice that we chose in the other document, that bezmen will determine that I'm acting improperly by not giving you a gift, and then he'll write, I hereby obligate myself to give you $1,000,000 for every week that I don't give you the gift from the time that the bezmen determines that I'm acting improperly. So that's already a guzma, that's an exaggeration. So the husband right now is lovey-dovey with the wife. They're not even married yet. So he thinks that it's never going to happen. They love each other. He thinks this will never come to fruition. They will have to be obligated to give the $1,000,000 penalty. So this is what the Gemara considers asmachta. This is a guzma. Because it's an exaggeration. So the halacha would be asmachta lokalia. Even if the bezmen would determine that he's acting improperly, but not giving a gift, he wouldn't have to give the $1,000,000. So the rabbanim should insist the husband should not write an exaggerated amount of money. He should write a reasonable amount of money, but a reasonable amount that will hurt him, that'll be significant. So let's say the husband will write, in the event that the bezmen will determine I'm acting improperly, so from that time on, I obligate myself now to give you support to the tune of $1,000 a week. $1,000 a week, $50,000 a year. That's all unreasonable. A lot of people need $50,000 a year to live on their own. Or the wealthy people even write $2,000 a year. $2,000 a week. So that's what the overwhelming majority of the poskim are of the opinion, that this will not constitute asmachta. And this is a valid agreement and would be binding in court. Within the past month, I think there was a case of a woman who wanted a gift from her husband for the longest time. And the husband had a lawyer who was acting highly improperly. So the couple had filled out a prenuptial agreement in advance. And the husband already forgot that he filled out the prenuptial agreement. He wasn't feeling well by the time they were getting divorced. So the lawyer argued out in court, in secular court, that the prenuptial agreement was a forgery. That the rabbi, the notary public, everybody forged the whole document. The whole thing was shaken loose. So finally, the judge in court had to determine that the prenuptial agreement was not a forgery, and it was binding. So then he finally went to the bezin that they had chosen before they got married. The bezin said the husband was acting improperly, should have given his wife a gift a long time ago. A year ago, whatever it was. And then he had a choice of either giving the gift within 45 days or paying her thousands and thousands of dollars. And he finally decided to give it a gift. So the woman, the Aguna situation was solved because of this prenuptial agreement. Usually what happens is that if you have a prenuptial agreement, the husband will not start up with the wife. He knows that he stands to lose. And this will be our public court. This is a regular legal document. This will be upheld in the secular court, not only in a religious business. So it's recommended that every couple should fill out such a prenuptial agreement. A friend of ours, our friends had a, they totally got engaged, and the yeshiva boy didn't, he said he doesn't want to sign that prenuptial agreement. They kept on pressuring him, why not? He didn't want to give a reason, but they broke off the shidduch. What is he afraid of? What does he stand to lose over here? Why can't he agree to support his wife to the tune of $2,000 a week if the best will determine that he's acting improperly? So they broke off the shidduch of this, and I think they were right. The fellow must have been a character. Rabbi Gulick was supposed to come tonight just for fun. He was the one who worked out this prenuptial agreement. He was supposed to present this, but he wasn't able to show up, so that's why I present. I just want to add on a little bit more, just a few words about some of the work that Borah does. We have to ascertain the facts of the case. There are always two versions, two sides to the story, sometimes more than two sides to the story. So the people from Borah have an obligation to work very conscientiously to make sure that the woman's version of the story is either fully accurate or sufficiently accurate that it should deserve to embarrass the husband. So when you make a big demonstration in front of the husband's home or in front of the husband's office, you're humiliating the husband. So do you have a right to humiliate someone? Do you have a right to distribute leaflets to say that the person is Mahagin's wife? This is outright Lashon Hara. It's true. If it wouldn't be true, it would be like Shemra. But if it's true, it's still in the solution heart. So the Gemara tells us that this prohibition of Ainoa's pardon to annoy someone, to irritate someone, the Lashon Hara doesn't apply when the person is doing something wrong. He's doing an Aveira, and you humiliate him in this area of the Aveira that he's doing. We had a couple who lived here in the neighborhood, in the building next to mine, 44 bed, and the husband refused to give his wife a get. So everybody was talking themselves blue and nothing helped. So the people from Mora spoke to the husband, spoke themselves blue, they didn't get anywhere. So they asked me, would I write a letter, an open letter to the people in the shul, where he davened, that they will not allow him to daven in the shul anymore, they will not allow him to get any aliyahs until he gives his wife a get. He's acting improperly, they weren't living together anyway. So he must give his wife a get. So when they showed the letter, the gabbai in the shul showed the letter to the husband, that week the get was taken care of. They didn't need any demonstrations, they didn't need any embarrassment or humiliations or anything. So sometimes you can solve the problem just by threatening to expose the improper action or activities of the husband. If that's not sufficient, the threat alone, then Allah says that you're permitted to humiliate the husband, to embarrass him. This is called the Harchot HaSod HaRab Intam. Intam is the one who said that even if there are cases we have that doesn't have the right to force the husband to give a get, that means to beat him up, to physically beat him up, bludgeon him to either die or to give the wife a get. Either should become an Amman or should become a Grusha, one or the other. So sometimes we don't always allow the desmond to bludgeon a person, to beat him up until he agrees to give a get. But to embarrass him in public if he's doing wrong, and of course this has to be checked out many times in order to make sure that the effects are correct. So then we do have the right to embarrass the person. Hamavad Yosef has a children when he writes that he followed this practice on several occasions. When the husband refused to give a get, they organized such a campaign, such a harchok to Rabbi Intam, and they were successful. I want to commend the group of workers, especially Rabbi Stern, for their hard work. And he got me in a week. I'm very depressed. I spoke to Dr. Pelkowitz. I need a little help. I was working on a few, the little work that I do doesn't compare to the work that my Stern does, the other group does. Just this week, I had three different cases that they threw at me, and all of the three cases were very, very sick. So it's very depressing. And whatever you young people can do to help solve the problem by participating in a demonstration and so on, it's really a tremendous mitzvah. And the people in Orah have to make sure that they check over the facts many times over to make sure that they're not embarrassing the person improperly, and that we have the right to organize such campaigns. Thank you very much. I can apologize. Pesach, Chalmat Pesach is not the Delta, it's Yom Tov. So I was was asked to speak across the street. He wanted me to come a little early in order to greet the guests who were coming. So I apologize to ask to leave, but I think the panel is very important, and I think whoever can should really stay until the end to hear the full discussion.
I'd first like to thank Huli Yagid and the other members of the Akhna Advocacy Club, who've done a tremendous job organizing this event and the cleanup blitz that we just had in handing out folders to every single dorm room door, under every dorm room door in Whitewoodster. They've done a tremendous job. It's really an honor for me to speak at an event with Rosh Shachar and with Dr. Balkovitz. And it's an unfortunate privilege that I have to fight with Tamar, with her and on her behalf for her death. Thank you, Tamar, for having the courage to be with us here tonight. Just want to give a little bit of background about Bora and also talk about the pre-op and our experience at Bora with the pre-op. Oda was founded in 2002 by a group, as Dr. Belkovitz said, a group of you, a group of YU undergraduate students. They heard about an Akhna case from one of the Rosh Yeshiva here, and they asked what they could do. They were told, organize a protest rally, see if that helps. And it did. It resolved the case. And they started working on a few other cases, literally out of a YU dorm. Over the past 10 years, we've grown into a full non-profit organization. We're now working at this point on about 70 Akhna cases, open Akhna cases throughout the world, basically in every major Jewish community that you can think of. Unfortunately, no community is immune to this problem. So that's the bad news. The good news is we have assisted in resolution of 172 Akhna cases in the past 10 years. Ora's approach combines facilitation with advocacy. Whenever we take on a case, we always try and resolve it amicably at first by, as Rosh Shachar mentioned, looking deep into the facts of the case, trying to triangulate the evidence, make sure that we're not just hearing from one side, but from many different points of view, and to look at the facts and the paper trail of the case. We always try and resolve things amicably at first by opening lines of communication between the two sides, by trying to facilitate the debate process, to do whatever we can to avoid a confrontation and to work with both parties. I don't want to say that we don't represent either party. We represent the get. Our concern is that once a marriage is irreconcilable, a get will be issued unconditionally and in a timely fashion. But in situations where, in many cases, are resolved through this facilitation, this amicable approach. But if it comes to a situation where we've exhausted all possibility of resolving it amicably, then we will use all halakhically acceptable and civilly legal forms of pressure that are available to us. And we'll talk about some of the pressure that we've used in tomorrow's case. When it comes to any halakhic issues, we do consult with Rosh Shachar, who's our co-stick. I want to talk a little bit about the prenup and why it's so important. The prenup, the halakhic prenuptial agreement, has been 100% effective in assuring that a get is given in a timely fashion. We look at our cases at ORA, and we go through the list. We've done this in our office. And we see just case after case after case that could have been prevented had a prenup been signed. Signing a prenup is not for you, per se. Whenever a couple comes to our office and we help them with the prenup, just to notarize it and things like that, I say that, you know, the people coming to our office are very excited to sign the prenup, and I never anticipate that they will leave themselves. They're signing it, and everyone here has to sign it. Not necessarily for yourself, but for someone else. Someone else who might not be in this room tonight and hasn't heard this message, because we need the signing of the halakhic prenuptial agreement to become a communal standard, that everyone does it within our community, so that we can effectively eradicate this problem from our community. It's like a vaccine. If everyone takes the vaccine, the disease can go away, because everyone has been immunized from the problem. That's what the prenup does. It's so effective. We need to make it a communal standard that everyone does. This is the prenup that my wife and I signed before we got married. And when I signed that, I actually thought it was kind of romantic. Right? Some people say, what do you mean it's romantic? You're talking about divorce at the time of marriage. I first remind them, that's what the Tsuba says. The Tsuba talks about divorce at the time of marriage. But putting that aside, if the Tsuba, if the Tsuba was written in Aramaic and made fancy writing about it in designs, everyone would sign, I'm sorry, the prenup was written in Aramaic and we had fancy, you know, pictures around it. Everyone would sign it. The problem is written in legalese and it's a very imposing document, but it's not so scary. It's a very good thing. So when I signed it, what I was saying to my wife, is that I love you so much, I care about you so much, that I never want to hurt you. Divorce brings out the worst in people. The way your book describes it is signing the prenup is protecting yourself from yourself. People do things in a divorce situation that they otherwise would never do. And it's hard, very hard to anticipate when getting married. And when getting married, and as chapter 7, you're lovey-dovey, to anticipate what someone will be like in the most difficult of times in a divorce situation. But it's protecting yourself from yourself. And if someone refuses to sign a halachic prenuptial agreement, that's a red flag. If someone won't sign it, don't marry them. I'm serious, don't marry them. Everyone must be able to say that I love you so much and I care about you so much that I never want to hurt you. That's what you're saying by signing the prenup, and you're not raising any concerns about the marriage, you're just doing it as a communal standard. The story I'd like to share, this is a true story, and it sends shivers down my spine when I think about it, but it really stresses the importance of what we're doing here tonight. This isn't the first time that there's been a panel here at NYU on agudot and prenuptial agreements. 10 years ago, shortly after ORA was founded in 2002, there was a panel, I believe, here in this room, in Weisberg Commons, with four panelists, from Schaffler, Joshua Ross, who was the founding director of ORA and my predecessor, Rabbi Yonah Reese, who at the time was the director of the Beit Din of America, and Michelle Greenberg-Cobrin. At the time, Michelle was practicing law, and she wrote the definitive article demonstrating that the halachic prenuptial agreement is binding in civil court, and indeed, there's case law out there which the prenup has stood up in civil court. And Michelle had the following message to share with everyone who was in the room 10 years ago. Michelle said that if every YU student and Stern student would sign the prenup, we can eradicate this problem from our community. And this is on YU Tori, if you listen to it, I think the Shearer's called it out, we're not convention, it's 2002. Michelle said that go out and tell your friends that everyone must sign the prenup. Tragically, two women who were at Stern College at the time, to no fault of their own, they didn't hear about the event, and none of their friends told them to sign the prenup, and they ended up meeting it. One was a girl who I went to high school with, who waited over 3 years for her again. The other was Tamar. And Tamar's waited over 4 years at this point for her again. None of her friends went from the panel 10 years ago to say, Tamar, you have to sign a prenup. She didn't know about it. Friends don't, this is the phrase we want to get out there. Friends don't let friends get married without a prenup. Okay? Friends don't let friends get married without a prenup. If a friend says to you, I want you to be a bridesmaid at my wedding or a groomsman at my wedding, you say, I'd love to. You're a dear friend. As long as you sign a prenup. When you have family members who are getting married, you say you better sign a prenup. As a family member, I love and care about you, you better sign a prenup. And this event is being live streamed to the parents who are listening to this. You tell your children, we won't pay for the wedding and we won't show up unless the prenuptial agreement is signed. We're really serious about this because this is a real problem within our community and there's no reason why every single person in this room and everyone who, our entire community should not sign the halachic prenuptial agreement. Because we cannot have more Tamar Epsteins in our community. This problem can be prevented. In 10 years from now, I hope that ORA will have no more cases. We'll go out of business due to a lack of business. But the problem is, the worst, my nightmare, is that if we look back and wish that someone in this room tonight would have said something to someone else. Someone in this room tonight would have said something to a certain student who is not in the room tonight, or another YU guy who is not in the room tonight. We have an obligation to act. Every person here must serve as an emissary to their community to make the prenup a standard within our community. It's in our hands to eradicate the problem of Hakuna from the community. Thank you.
Aaron Friedman's refusal to give me a gift. So Divorce is always painful, but the healing process cannot begin until the parties have completely disentangled themselves one from the other and begin to move on with his or her own life. And that's exactly what the Aguna can't do. And so she's kept trapped in this initial state of divorce, which is wrought with anger, resentment, pain, and mistrust. And it's most detrimental for the children if there are children involved. Children of divorced parents or divorcing parents are most affected by the trauma of the initial separation. But once the parents themselves begin to settle down and move on, the children similarly do better. But in a situation where there's step refusal, the children are also kept stuck in a high level of conflict where collaborative co-parenting is almost impossible. Who is the get refuser? Now, by Dr. Abraham Twersky posits in his book, Shameborn in Silence, that a get refusal is an act of abuse, of domestic abuse. And it is often that climactic act of abuse in that particular relationship. But the message that I want to leave with you tonight is that a get refuser is not born overnight or in a vacuum. I believe that a get refuser develops in large part in response to the messages that are both explicitly and implicitly conveyed to him by his community. We are people of compassion and esteem, and it's natural for us to feel uncomfortable in inserting ourselves into a conflict that appears to be private and personal between a divorcing husband and wife. And so all too often, we find ourselves saying, there must be two sides to this story. I'm sure if we shower him with kindness and validate his feelings, he'll come around and maybe then he'll give a get. Or I'm concerned that if we put too much pressure on him, he'll become too angry and distanced, and then he'll never give a get. I understand why people react in this way, but my experience has taught me that this is the wrong approach, and it results in the Orthodox community being too soft on get refusal. We do not need to judge the individuals involved. Who are we to judge? But we must judge the behavior. Get refusal is a corruption of halakha and punishes those who are adherent to Torah. It is never acceptable. It should never be considered acceptable to either withhold the issuance or acceptance of the get for any period of time. Our communal standard must be that a get must be given immediately and unconditionally when a marriage is dissolved. Aaron Friedman did not become a notorious get refuser overnight. For the first 2 years after our separation, there was essentially no pressure on him to give a get. He asserted that he was justified in withholding a get because he was unsatisfied with the terms of the visitation arrangement that had been adjudicated in court. And his family, friends, and Rabbanim did not challenge that assertion. I, like so many women, were fearful to antagonize him, and I thought it most prudent to approach the situation quietly, gingerly, and non-confrontationally, and above all, with patience. After 2 years of separation with all matters resolved, either in court or mediation, and a civil divorce pending, I asked her Rav, who had developed a relationship with Aaron, to approach him and beg him for a get for me. I did this because my father, Olav Shalom, who had been diagnosed with a terminal illness just months before, was dying. Although my father had accepted that he would never see me happily remarried, he was desperate to see me free. I was told that Aaron responded with such anger and cruelty to this request that it became clear to me that my quiet and gentle approach was not working. I had to try something different. And that's when I approached Ora. After thoroughly investigating my case, Ora agreed to get involved. And after attempting negotiation and mediation for an extended period of time to try to resolve the case in a discreet manner, Ora, like so many before and after, made no headway and concluded that they needed more public tactics. I do not know where I would be today without the commitment and expertise of Ora. Ora helped garner for me the rabbinic and public support that I needed so that I have not remained just another anonymous abuna. And progress is being made every day. Not only has my case received a lot of publicity, but there has also been an outpouring of support from all parts of the Jewish community. I feel tremendously indebted to each and every person who has participated in a live or virtual rally, signed petitions, been on Facebook, and have kept me in their prayers. I want to say a special thank you to the many Rabbanim and Rosh Yeshiva in Philadelphia, New York, Silver Spring, and Washington, D.C., who have guided and supported me throughout this process. The Aguna is amongst the most vulnerable person in the people in our community. We as a community have a responsibility to protect her and ensure her release. And we as a community can work towards that goal if we, ourselves, our institutions, and our leadership accept a zero-tolerance policy on get refusal. And in the merit of that commitment, may God look favorably upon us and send us a salvation to all those in need. Thank you.
So I've prepared a few remarks. To talk about Tamar's case, I think we need to... hear me fine? I think we need to broaden the picture and understand, as Tamar mentioned, that one of the issues here is community members not understanding that domestic abuse is never acceptable. Is that mic trying to move the mic over? Keep it as is? Okay. That domestic abuse is never acceptable. Domestic abuse, as Dr. Pelkovitz discussed, and as Tamar mentioned, is about control. Abuse is not just about black and blue marks, but controlling someone's life, their future, their freedoms. And just like we cannot tolerate physical abuse, so too we cannot tolerate emotional and psychological abuse. And it's sad how many people have come up in Tamar's case and said, well, it's justified for this reason or that reason. And I'll get into some of the specifics of the case. Get refusal is never justified. The get is the last vestige of control that an abusive individual has over their spouse. I believe that this case will be resolved once Aaron understands that nothing will be gained by withholding the get. Once he understands that the get may not be used as leverage. People have pressed Tamar to negotiate, as if negotiations haven't been tried many, many times. Custody and visitation should be determined according to what's in the best interest of the child. And when the two parties can't come to an agreement about custody and visitation in the best interest of the child, they will turn to a third party, a Beit Din, a child psychologist, a civil court, to make that determination. In this case, it was Aaron who was the plaintiff in the civil divorce matter, in all civil divorce matters, which determines custody and visitation. He was the one who said, the way I want custody and visitation to be decided is in civil court. And so now, once he didn't get everything that he wanted in civil court, he then moved to modify the court decision, and some modifications were made. But even then, he's not satisfied, and he still wants more. And he still wants Tamar to negotiate. But negotiations cannot be conducted when someone holds a gun to your head or a get over your head. In the last negotiation, Aaron literally walked away from the table after an agreement had been reached and the sofer was already called and was on his way to write the get. There were 9 months of quiet afterwards from Tamar and Aaron's last negotiation until the seru, the order of contempt, was issued against him and pressure was restarted. So my message to Aaron is, if you truly love your daughter, you'll stop abusing her mother. To clarify some points about the case, there was a question about Shabbos, that perhaps their daughter, or Aaron, was not able to have proper visitation due to issues of Shabbos. So first of all, Aaron was never denied access to their daughter due to his observance of Shabbos, and Tamar always made accommodations. And on top of that, in July 2011, the court order was modified so that Aaron's visitation is every other weekend, starting at Thursday at 5 p.m. until Sunday at 5 p.m. So even with amazing Tosefet Shabbos, with incredible chumrah, there are no Shabbos issues anymore whatsoever, as if there ever were. Aaron has a third of the days of the calendar year with their daughter. People have also asked about the legality of pressuring Aaron's employer, Congressman Dave Camp, to make a statement against Aaron for refusing to issue a get. So this is legal. It's very common in politics to pressure lawmakers to take a stand on issues of concern to the Jewish community. Consider Jonathan Pollard, the Obama administration's support of Israel. There are many issues in which we press lawmakers to take a stand and make a statement on an issue that's important to the Jewish community. To be extremely clear, we are not asking Congressman Camp to fire Aaron. We are asking Congressman Camp to make a statement condemning Aaron's refusal to issue Tamar again. Previously, his office had referred to the case as gossip. This is not gossip, this is abuse. Aaron must hear from everyone in his life, from his employer, his family, and his friends, that what he's doing is inexcusable. Aaron's cruel manipulation of halacha is a chilul Hashem. It is a kiddush Hashem when we stand up and say that we will not tolerate this abuse within our community.
Thank you. Thank you. Dr. Falkovitz, it's clear that there's a difference between civil divorce proceedings, between negotiation, and between what constitutes abuse. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit about what you see as the line between the two. Maybe from a more psychological perspective.
So the difference between negotiation and abuse is exactly what we just heard and so eloquently from Rabbi Stern. The second you start to use control as a way of trying to get your way, the second you close yourself off to the other perspective, it starts to become a continuation of what's emotionally abusive. It's interesting. If you take a picture of a brain at the moment that it's being emotionally abused, the same part of the brain lights up as lights up when it's being physically assaulted. That's exactly what it's like. It's no different than a physical assault. Negotiation is about getting curious about what the other side is thinking. Negotiation is about perspective taking. It's about give, it's about a take. It's about not trying to get your way. It's about being an adult in terms of trying to look at how to come to some kind of a mutually agreeable exercise, compromise. The second that you cross the line into a control and into a situation where you're going to really distort what halacha is all about as a way of trying to wring out more concessions or wring out your way, it's right away crossing the line into abuse.
Thank you. Just a question for you, which is not to put too fine a point on it, but we've read about that a little bit for you, and I was wondering if you could, just to make it clear to everyone, how your situation would be different if you had known about it right now, if you had signed it, and lost the wires.
It's true that I did not attend this panel discussion when I was a sophomore at Stern. Regretting that for now. I think the prenup may very well have helped, very, very likely have helped in my situation. I think I really haven't learned about it until more recently, and it does seem to me like a pretty brilliant solution in that unless an individual is so fabulously wealthy that $55,000 a year over several years means nothing to them, or if their vindiction is greater than their greed, it might not be that effective in those situations. But I would expect that by and large, even in situations where get refusal would otherwise have occurred, I think by and large it could be very, very effective in preventing from upfront or curtailing that process.
Thank you. Any questions? I'll repeat the question.
Okay. You specifically mentioned to ask to tell your friends we're getting married, and I'm wondering if it's appropriate to do so. And I was personally told it was by my college teacher and like my brother-in-law was married, and some other kind of figures that you move to from that kind of information for a friend that might seem somewhat insulting or somewhat awkward to them. You mentioned that. How would you do that?
To repeat the question, in terms of the health of prenup, it seems kind of awkward for a friend to just go over to a friend and say, by the way, silence. So if Rabbi Stern can explain how best to approach friends or who should be the one approaching.
And the question was asked specifically about should rabbis and college teachers be encouraging the use of the prenup and saying this is something that must be done? The answer is unequivocally yes. Yes, the college teachers and rabbis should absolutely instruct people to use the halach prenuptial agreement. My wife teaches college classes, and she tells all of the college that she teaches to use the prenup. We've done some in our living room. So you know, there's no question. And the Rabbinical Council of America has issued three resolutions, either strongly encouraging and endorsing the use of halachic prenuptial agreements. The fact of the matter is that, for whatever reason, it's not yet become a standard. And so what I would suggest is, since it's not yet become a standard from the top down, we need to have the pressure come from the bottom up. And it may be uncomfortable, but the flip side and the potential tragedy is that much worse. And the idea is, again, to say this is a communal standard, and this is something that I did or I will do, and it's to protect our community, not because you have any, you know, questions about your friend's fiancé or something like that, but just that it should be a communal standard, separated from the individuals, and talk about the standards of the community.
I guess this question would be more appropriate for Belshazzar, but I guess for Rabbi Stern. Why isn't there more pressure from the RCA for that those rabbis who participate for when they're asking about execution, that they will refuse to be Masada execution unless the couple signs it right now? Why?
Working on it. Then the question, just for the recording, why shouldn't there be a requirement by RCA rabbis to be Masada Kedushin, only with the prenup? We're working on it. The other fact is that not all rabbis who are Masada Kedushin in weddings within our community are RCA rabbis. So, you know, there are many ways that it can still fall through the cracks, whereas, again, if it's a communal standard, a rabbi is one individual, but we have so many friends and so many family members, and so the possibility of reaching everyone is that much greater when we put the burden of responsibility on the community members themselves. I take a lot of heat in my job, so this is how it goes.
You all know, most of the majority of the cases, the woman was the victim. We all know that men are also victims. Mm-hmm. If the woman refuses to take the get, or she refuses to go have the civil courts. So number one, what is Ora doing about that? Number two, can that problem also be solved? Both people signing the prenuptial, they both have to give the money when it's decided whoever is the person who's using.
Absolutely. So the question was about, what about cases of agunim, where a wife refuses to receive the get, and a wife uses a get as leverage, and things are not done according to halacha. So again, the prenup would be very effective in assuring that they're both going to go to Beis Din, to go to rabbinical court, and have issues adjudicated there, particularly for the get. And the other question is about the standard prenuptial agreement. It just goes one way. It says if the husband refuses to issue the get, there is a reciprocal version, and that's the one that we have in the packets that we've distributed, and it's available upon request, so that there's a reciprocal version which goes both ways. If the wife refuses to receive the get, then she would have a financial penalty for not receiving get for every day. I would, and so these, there are cases that happen. I venture to say that about 98% of the cases that have come to our desks at ORA have been situations where a husband refuses to issue a get. We have had a handful of cases that it goes the other way, and so we should be aware of that as well. But just like one would find, and maybe Dr. Belkowitz could talk about this, that often there's the percentages of, in terms of domestic abuse victims, is highly weighed towards women. This, as a form of domestic abuse, is the same type of thing that very often, in the vast majority of cases, at least what from what I've seen, the victims are women. Though again, there can be situations where a wife refuses to receive the get as well. And like I said before, we advocate for the get. So there are men who have called our offices, and we've tried to advocate on behalf of the husbands to ensure that the wife receives the get unconditionally.
No, I mean, look, the reality is that when it comes to abuse in general, there does seem to be a disproportionate preponderance of men over women, although interesting, when it comes to domestic violence, it depends on level of severity, and the reality is actually a little more complex than that. But I'm very happy to hear that answer, because I think it's extremely important, you know, that we do have to be even-handed. I think that I've seen the plight sometimes of a man who is not able to move on because of a wife refusing to receive a get. And I think it's so important to hear that you know that we're being, you know, that we're acting in the way that we're asking others to act. I mean, that we're open to perspectives on both sides and not blindly seeing this as a purely a gender related issue, because right. It's not. Although, again, obviously, in the vast majority of cases, we all know that it's almost always it's almost completely a woman's issue.
So this question is also directed for Rabbi Schechter. Rabbi Schechter mentioned when he spoke that you deal with cases in which a bein din has determined that a man is committing inappropriately by refusing his wife to get. I was wondering if there are cases where his refusal would be considered legitimate for any reason and how you would determine that.
It's a great question. I will repeat the question. The question that's asked is, are there situations where it's acceptable to withhold the get and to not issue it immediately? I think there are two ways that we have to think about this. One is, and this is what Rav Schechter has said in other situations, what Rav Schechter was referring to, from my understanding, are situations where at what point can we pressure outwardly the husband to give the get. That is separate from the husband's moral obligation to give the get once the marriage is deemed irreconcilable. And as Tamar mentioned, our approach is that once the marriage is irreconcilable, the get should be given as soon as possible. There may be situations where we won't pressure the husband to give the get, and there are halachic issues involved in when you're allowed to apply pressure, and that's only once a beit din deems the husband is halachically considered a get recalcitrant, that he's refused to give the get. So the issue is really one of timing, not an issue of is it acceptable to use the get as leverage? There's no question about that. It's not acceptable to use the get as leverage. But there may be an argument to be made that in some cases the get should be given at the end of the civil divorce or once all issues are adjudicated in some sort of fair forum. And so I'll give an example. If a wife, steals $1 million from the husband and runs away across the world, right? So the husband, she's acted completely inappropriately. So the husband is entitled to his fair day in court, and he may say that she has broken the law on countless occasions, and so therefore, and he'll turn to a beit din. A beit din may say you should perhaps have the get deposited in beit din, but the get will be issued once she starts to comply with the law if she's been breaking the law. So that might be some sort of situation like that. But once there's been a fair hearing on the issues, whether in beit din or civil court, then there's, from my perspective, and this is what Rav Schechter has instructed us on many occasions, once there's been some sort of fair trial, hearing, settlement that's been offered, there's no excuse for the get not to be issued.
Okay. Last question.
So what's the basis for the halachic objection or opposition to the prenup? Why would anyone say you can't sign?
What's the basis for the halachic opposition to the prenup? As Rav Schechter mentioned, it's very few and far between. It's a minority of opinion. By and large, the opposition that I've heard from Rabbanim to the prenup, with one exception, with a Rav who has technical halachic objections to it, but by and large, the resistance by Rabbanim to using the prenup is a concern of you shouldn't talk about divorce at the time of marriage. And there was a certain Rosh Yeshiva from a yeshiva outside of this yeshiva who I spoke with because he was going to be Masada Kedushin at that wedding. And the groom said to me, I told him, you should sign a prenup. He says, whatever my Masada Kedushin, my Rosh Yeshiva says. And so I called the Rosh Yeshiva, and I said, are you using a halachic prenuptial agreement? And he said, well, they shouldn't talk about divorce at the time of marriage. So I said, are you going to do a ksuba at the wedding? And he said, yes. And I said, well, the ksuba talks about divorce, and they're talking about divorce at the time of marriage, and the husband has to know the obligations that he's accepting upon himself by giving the wife the ksuba. So he said, well, you have to have lawyers drafted and this and that. And I said, it's already drafted. It's right here, ready to go. I'm a notary. I can notarize it for him. No problem. And he said, well, they shouldn't talk about divorce at the time of marriage. I'm like, wait. Well, we are, and that was the, my conversation. I couldn't make that up. So that was the resistance. I think it's really just an issue of it being communally accepted and as a standard, and to break this stigma. As was mentioned before, there's a certain stigma to signing prenuptial agreements. We have to break that stigma and to say that this is a communal standard. Was that the last question? So I want to ask a question to Tamar. And I didn't prep you for this. So the question that I want to ask to Tamar, and other people have asked me about this, so that's why I'd like to hear your perspective on it, is how do you maintain your emuna in all this? Meaning, how do you keep on fighting? Because I can't imagine the experience personally, and what keeps you going on?
It's actually an effort. It's a big effort, and it's something that I work on every day. And some days are harder than others. But to something that Dr. Popovitz spoke about, which I really resonated with me, was the concept of when you're helping somebody else in need, when someone's struggling with something, and you're doing it alone and without support, it can be almost unbearable. And I think that that's exactly when you end up with a situation. You made reference to Avinot, who many of whom are so depressed and so disillusioned that they almost can't go on day to day. And so I think the key for me has been my incredible support network. My family, first and foremost. My mother's here, and I'm just very fortunate for tremendous family love and support. Close friends, some of whom I see here, and I'm can't believe it. And Rabbanim, when Rabbanim stand behind you and are willing to write a letter on your behalf and sign it with their name, they're making a very big statement and they're doing something bold. And that show of support is tremendous. It validates. It's validating. Because the hardest thing, I think, for me going through this is not only dealing with the pain of and the ordeal of divorce itself and being trying to parent well and trying to move on with my own life and, you know, figure that all out, but it's also being judged quite a bit. And it's like not only am I suffering with this, but on top of it, now there are a million accusations out there about my behavior, my past behavior, my current behavior, my future behavior, all sorts of assertions. And so that, in a way, was, I think, the most painful thing for me. And once I started to see the incredible support and solidarity from the Rabbanim, from the community, it made a world of difference. And I've certainly come to terms with the fact that I don't need everyone to agree with what I'm doing or to support me. There are going to be people who see things differently. But when you have this kind of showing, and when you have the kind of support that I've had, it means so much. It makes a world of difference. And there's no question that that's definitely helped me struggle, so thank you all. We have the privilege to hear from some truly inspiring people. And I thank you for coming to speak with us. Thank you for coming. I have to thank, of course, the TAC board for making this happen, a tireless statement.
is not a men's issue, it's not a woman's issue, it's in fact something that we as a community have to face and have to stand united against. So whatever it is that you do, whether you encourage a friend to sign the prenup, you make sure that all your friends sign the prenup, we put them on your doors. Whether you come and you show up and you show support, you show that you care, when you attend a rally, when you sign a petition, all of these things make a difference. You never know when, you never know who's the tipping point. Make sure that you care. Make sure that you do what you can. And thank you for